Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Nebraska. Welcome back to Deliver This Your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and I've been getting a little crafty. I've been trying to find something that does not involve me sitting at a computer, which is what I do a lot of the time. So something that gets me up and off my feet. So I've been playing around with furniture stuff. I've been playing around with cooking in the kitchen, all kinds of things to try to find something that can get my mind off of computers, get my mind off of products, but not that far off products because I still use products and tools in those endeavors. So I've been exploring and playing around with that. Need different hobbies. What do you do? Let me know. Or if you have a suggestion for something I should try, let me know that too. And I really hope you've enjoyed the last two episodes. We've had a Metacast month in September with Bob and Josh being on the show. Great to talk to both of them about product-related topics, and glad they were able to attend. A couple of things I read over the last few weeks. The first one is from Mike Cohen, a very similar topic to one we talked about last episode. He has an article titled, or a blog post titled, "Is It Time to Do Away with Scrum's Product Owner Role?" Very similar in concept to the article we had last time about a similar topic, and what happens when not having a product owner breaks. Mike's really interesting article talking about, is it time to share the role of product owner among other team members? Kind of like some teams do with Scrum Master. We always talk about T-shaped people, cross-functional skills, testers or other specialty things, design, analytics, any other type of role or skill set. Is it time to share that skill set or let the teams make collaborative product decisions as they do other decisions, kind of like architecture? There, the goal would be on the product person or the product specialist, if you will, selling the others on the ideas of collaborative product decisions instead of telling them what to do or why things are important. The teams would actually share in those decision-making, share in those discovery processes, share in all those other aspects. And he also posits that, is this the way that it's supposed to happen? Is it supposed to be something where a product owner role disappears from the team? The skill set is actually absorbed there. I'm always interested in this. It's something that I see a lot of people talk of. I know there are some teams that operate like this. Again, if this works for you, great. If it doesn't work for you, you know, what does? It's an interesting thing to think about, an interesting topic to explore. I'm always curious if this means that the role of product goes away. If there's a product manager or a product leader or somebody else that's in charge of thinking about product decision goes away, if everything is absorbed at the team level, or is some of it absorbed at the team level, most of it absorbed at the team level. I don't know. I'm always curious when people want to get rid of the product owner role, what else does that look like they're getting rid of? Is it just that role, or is it other things as well? But I definitely agree with sharing those information, sharing those things that we've talked about in the whole context of the a series of episodes that we've done about product owners being collaborative with their teams and helping share information, share stories, and share why things need to be done. So interesting take from Mike. Be interesting to see what everybody else comes up with. There was a lot of comments on that. I need to read through his article. Stimulated a lot of response. So I'll go through that and see if there's anything interesting to pull out. The other article I read was from Hilla Miller, who has something called Fuel and Friction, 5 Behavioral Economics Lessons for Product Managers. Of course, I had to put this one in there because it's one of my favorite topics. A couple of the things that she picked out, very interesting idea about friction. The idea that friction is, small amounts of frictions are what really tick people off and really prevent them from moving forward. She has a couple different cases that she goes over. But one of the statements really struck me, which is people, when you're trying to change their behavior or trying to get their behavior to change, people would prefer doing nothing to doing something. So getting them to try some action, even if it benefits them, they likely will not, because that means changing their behavior. And that's something that they usually won't do voluntarily. Very interesting thought process. And again, experimenting with that and finding ways to find those friction points or to remove those friction points as much as you can in your products and your applications and in your processes. A really good section on meeting users where they are, looking for unexpected results and ideas, thinking how this product will be used and what context it'll be used, or how this behavior is being used, and not doing it from your place of work, but doing it from their place of work, or where they would actually be trying this app at, trying this product out at, is really core concept to understanding what the users are trying to do with your application. And really that leads to the third thing that I really liked in this, was talking about the user's satisfaction and how really the user's satisfaction is how much of the problem do you solve for them? That's really what drives a lot of value conversations, conversion conversations, and getting those behaviors to change in a positive way by determining how much of that problem that you can take away from them, you remove from them, you make them happy that they don't have to deal with it anymore. Whatever their problem is, whether it's financial, banking, photography, you know, pick your product problem and how that gets resolved. But that's a really interesting notion of satisfaction. How much of this problem do we solve for them, and what would they value that as? So really good articles from Mike and Hilla this week. Hope you enjoy them.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
The topic for today was a suggestion from a listener a while ago. It's been a while since we talked about backlogs, so let's dive in. The question was, how do you manage or work with one or multiple product backlogs when managing multiple client projects with the same team? Something that I'm sure there are other listeners who are working with this problem as well. One of the questions from last week was very similar, how to deal with multiple backlogs or show multiple backlogs. My standard approach is to have one backlog that everything goes into. It's all work, and it all has to be prioritized or ranked to decide what we'll do first, next, and so on. It's easier as product owners, teams, and people who want to know what we have to work from to see it as a single ordered list. The more lists we try and make that are, quote, special, unquote, the harder it is to see, make decisions, and share information. Kitty Rubin has a similar rule of one product equals one backlog. And that seems to work pretty well. As the initial question suggests, though, what happens when you have multiple products and only a single team? Or what about a new product and an old product? Different projects and clients with the same team. I've had situations like that before where different client reps or sponsors were coming to me with their lists that they were working with on their specific clients. This was usually not a good situation. Each client would think their list is the most important because it's happening to them. As a product leader, you have to look at the balance of issues and see which are the most important to tackle. That's why taking those multiple customer lists and putting it as one will help you see whose issue should be solved first, or if there's some common issues all customers are having. Wouldn't solving those first help the most people? So let's rank that high and work on that next. If you have multiple products a single team has to support, then something I like to do is work with an allotment budget or product priority list. Let's use the old product, new product situation. There's a legacy product that exists, and our single team has to support that while at the same time building a new dynamic mobile version of the product that our customers complain about. First thing to establish is, of course, there are only so many hours in a day, only so much time that the team has available to do work on anything. If we're willing to hire another team or choose to ignore, priority-wise, one of the things we're being asked to do, then great. We can look at more options. If not, then time and availability is something you have to start with. Remember the sustainable pace principle here and keep to it. Yes, months of overtime might be what you did in a waterfall project. We're not going to do that. If it's too much, then we say so and we deal with that reality. Don't agree or be pressured into making bad decisions because someone else made one. It's a good teaching moment to show why that's not possible. Team burnout, crappy quality, and long delivery cycles are some of the problems I've seen when that happens. So how do you split the time you have available between competing products? There are many ways to do this. I've done a few of them well in different situations. My favorite option is to give an iterations focus to one of the products. Let's say that we will do two sprints on the new product and then a sprint on the old product. This way we are working 100% on one area, one goal, and delivering on that. After some progress made on that, then we do some catch-up work for a time on the old product. This split works and seems to be received well if you frame it right. Informing interested people, every 6 weeks, our team will be delivering new capabilities for our new mobile app and maintaining our current customers' needs as we go. This macro statement is correct. We are adding to the new and supporting the old. How we do that is we give two sprints to the new and one to the old, and then we can repeat it until we do not need the old one anymore. At current pace, that looks like X number of sprints, months, time, whatever. You can vary it, of course, to meet your specific needs. That 2-to-1 ratio has a clear priority for the new over the old. It could be 3-to-1, 5-to-2, whatever works best for you. Another way to do it is to try and split the team's focus and do 50-50 iterations. Half the sprint's work is on product A and half is on product B. I also have done this when necessary, and I didn't like it. It's multitasking, which is a bad thing. What happens when you chase two rabbits? They both get away. Maybe it's not 50-50, but 80-20 or something else. Budgeting or allocating a sprint to work on various projects, products, or other categories is useful in some situations. I'll come back to this idea in a bit. Splitting usually happens when some progress has to be made on all the things in the backlog. You as a PO can't get the customer, sponsors, or whoever to understand that not all things are equally important. So you give in a bit and do a little something for everyone. This makes them happy in the moment and maybe stops the call because you've agreed to work on their thing. However, that thing will not likely be done for a longer period of time because the team can't focus on it, if it was even necessary to begin with. Even though you might deliver it at a similar point on the calendar as the other option, which is to focus on it every few sprints, in this one, the WIP was too high, the cycle and the lead time will suffer, and what should be your company's priorities and visions are being pushed back for what could be lower priority work. Whichever way you choose, you still need a ranked list of priorities for the old and the new, product A, product B, and then a way to show them together. This is where, even if you have separate Jira projects or lists, you find a way to show them together. Also, something I do a lot is to add categories or those buckets of where and how we spend the team's time on things. I try and keep it to a small number, which is less than 5, of the different categories, things like product A work, product B work, client request, features, regulatory. Those are some of the common outward-facing ideas. Then having items like support or tech debt, maintenance, those are more internal-focused things to do. Showing each epic and story on your backlog with those items and budgeting the time, maybe it's a release or a quarter or these sprints, with those categories in mind can help you work with all the things that need to get done. Seeing those items in your backlog together helps understand the situation better. From that backlog, I've also used different views to show only the thing that someone was interested in. If you wanted to see all the mobile product epics or stories, then you can see those here. This is handy for those account reps who want to see their clients' things. It's easy for you to do it this way and still flip back to the big view when it needs to be shown where they really are. What are the other competing priorities for this specific category? I've done a few other things with backlogs, some helpful, some not. Most backlogs are too big. I mentioned the Dunbar number before, and I still like the concept of about 150 things in a backlog being its maximum size. These could be some epics, some stories, defects, spikes, whatever. All told, we don't go over that number. The best way to not go over that number is, of course, to say no. No, this new thing is something we won't do. It doesn't align with our strategy, our priorities, or our mission, so we won't pretend that we'll get around to it at some point. We're just going to say no. If you can't say no to it, then what does it replace? Go through the list and take something else off, or work with the needed folks to find something that this will displace. Those conversations are hard. It should be. Again, we're dealing with limited time, people, and the most important things to work on. I usually go through backlogs and try to weed them as much as possible. Especially true if you're new to a product or an effort. There's usually too much work to do. Backlogs of hundreds or thousands of items are ridiculous. They need to be tamed. Start by looking at the date an item was created and the last time they were updated. If it was created over a year ago and no one has updated or talked about it in 6 months, it's time to delete it. I like Alan's thoughts here of having aging or expiration dates on items. If we can't get to something in 3 months' time, then it expires. It goes bad. It goes away. It might be able to be brought up again later. That's an effort that's not on you, the product owner, to do, though. If it's really important, it'll come back when it's time. If it doesn't, that's a good indication that it wasn't necessary to begin with, or that there's something else that we should do instead. Keeping a graveyard, a deep freeze, or maybe some other name for a backlog that contains things that gets kicked out of the real backlog isn't ideal. This is usually done so someone isn't mad or unhappy that their thing isn't being tracked somewhere. While it's not a good strategy, it is usually a stepping stone to that good, lean backlog that we want, though. I've had a lot of discussions when starting to work with new groups about weeding their backlogs. They are so scared the thing that's been there for 3 years and hasn't yet been touched is going to disappear. It will. It deserves to. There's more important things. Let's admit that and move on to better. I've worked with teams that when they see some sort of request or problems come in and they want to hold on to those things instead of saying no to them right away, they are afraid they will upset the requester or cause some negative perception to occur. I love the concept that saying yes is the easier response. However, when you say yes to something, you're saying no to everything else. Or if it's an insincere yes, then not only do you delay the pain of no later, you set an expectation that you will prioritize something that clearly will not be. Saying, yes, we will add that feature to our backlog. Look for more information in 3 years. If you don't say that, then say no. Something else that will help is to show the amount of inventory in the backlog. The cumulative flow diagram can do this as well. Everything that is in the one product backlog, including the in-progress and delivered items, are visible to see. If the block of new items makes up the bulk of the chart, and it's only growing, either because the requests are coming in faster than they are getting done, or things are not getting out to customers at all, then you have a flow problem that needs to be corrected first. Showing the labels or the allocations that you have for those items can be useful as well. Try your best to make things obvious to anyone. Having others see the issue is a lot better than you telling them. I'm a firm believer now, more than I ever was, about giving people the information and helping them see, experience, and learn from themselves rather than me trying to drill something into their head. That produces much better outcomes. It's slower, frustrating, but better. The first rule of digging holes is when you see that you're in one, stop. POs can help the org see how deep they are and offer a way out. These are hard conversations that need to happen. Explore options focused on the product vision and strategy and let it work for you. Stop the bleeding. Hopefully, that gives you some ideas on how to work with multiple backlogs or some information about how to work with your backlog differently than you have been. It's also something that should not take up a lot of your time. Yes, POs are responsible for the backlog. If that is consuming too many cycles and it feels like that's all you're doing day to day, take this as an opportunity to think through how to improve it. If you're getting value from the show, please do subscribe, share it with friends, and let me know what connects with you. For any feedback or questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at Delivercast or email at delivercast@gmail.com. A couple of questioners I saw this week from Mohammed, who asks, can a product owner change a sprint backlog any day? Sprint backlog. Okay, when you say sprint backlog, I assume you mean the work that the team is working on today. The sprint has started. The sprint backlog is there. Can a product owner change it? General, no. Once the sprint is started, that work is kind of there, and that's supposed to be what the team is focused on and working on. If you need to make a change to it, you can talk to the team about the change. Maybe there's a lower priority story you want to swap in or out. If everybody agrees to that, then cool. Maybe the top priority story, the team's discovered something, and they say, we're not going to be able to get this story done. What do we want to do? Then yes, the sprint backlog is going to change, but it's not just you unilaterally changing the sprint backlog. If the sprint hasn't started yet, if you're talking about the next sprint backlog, then yeah, you can update that. You can have a conversation with the team about why we need to make a change and then go through and change those priorities if you need to. But once the sprint started, unless you have to blow it up, and again, I've only blown up two sprints in like 6 years because something happened that the rest of those stories didn't matter. That's a very rare occasion, but usually that's done in conjunction with Scrum Master and the team saying, here's why we're going to do this, or here's why we need to do this, I should say, and then have a conversation with them. The other question was from Merrill, who asked, have you ever heard of product owners giving career advice to team members? He's seeing some developers, some testers on the team that want to talk to their product owner about to give them some mentoring or some advice on how to go through their careers. Yes. Short answer is yes. It's not unusual, especially if you're talking about somebody out of college who's a developer on a team or doesn't have a lot of experience, and the product owner does, if they've been in the business industry, longer, whether it's 5 to 10 years or more, and the person who's asking for advice, they're perfectly fine, just like any relationship, talking about, what they want to do. Maybe they want to be a product owner, or maybe they want to be a designer or something else, and they just need somebody with experience to talk about, how does that happen? Have they seen that before? Maybe they don't feel comfortable talking to their own manager about it because they might shoot it down, or because they think that, developers should say developers, testers should say testers, something like that. So I've definitely given advice to team members. I've definitely talked just openly or just listened openly to people who wanted to have a conversation with me. I've talked about and shared my story about how I got to the point that I've gotten to and all the ways that I've gotten there. I've talked to people. I've used them as mentors, as career advice as well. There's nothing wrong with advice. There's nothing wrong with listening. And as far as I'm concerned, anybody can do that. I've gotten advice from a career, from development managers, from Scrum Masters, from coaches as well, because it just helps to have somebody to listen to. And if the team looks to you as a leader, and very often that does happen, then yeah, I think you should be able to talk to them without any problems about career advice. And exploring that with them. So I definitely would not shy away from that if given the opportunity. Hope that helps. Thank you for those questions. And also, by the way, episode 100, Scary, is coming up in a few weeks. And one of the things I want to do, so usually the last episode of a season, I just do a full question episode. And also because this is episode 100, one of the things I'd like to do is do a open retrospective. So what I'd like is anybody who's listening to this now, there will be a link in the show note to a open Trello board that I'd like to get your feedback on the show. I've posted some questions out there. You can feel free to respond to some of those prompts. Or if you just have a question about the show, you have a question about product ownership, or if you want to celebrate episode 100, if you want to write a note into the email or the Twitter, you can do that. What would be really cool is if you could record yourself saying something, send that into the show, and then I will play it back on episode 100. So we'll start pushing that a little bit more as we get closer, but I wanted to open it up a little bit early and let folks go through if they can, and if they're interested in giving the show, giving me some feedback. That would be great as we start to think about what to do for next season. So I would appreciate it if listeners would go and check that out. Thank you very much. And if you're in need of any one-to-one coaching or consulting to help you find your product owner balance, check out seektaiju.com. All the opinions expressed here are mine. You can find more of them at Corey Bryant on Twitter. That is episode 98, Delivered. Go out and own the outcome. Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.